Schweizer Amerika. Views from the Sister Republic. A University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler. Grüezi miteinander and welcome to another episode of Views from the Sister Republic. This time we'll deal with, well, what might be a transatlantic divorce. We can look back at the 61st Security Conference in Munich, where Vice President J.D. Vance appeared on stage. There was a warm applause in the beginning. Then he said, well, I hope this is not the last time I get applause here. It nearly was. His speech wasn't the warm, fuzzy confirmation of the transatlantic ties that bind Europe with the United States. Instead, it was a scolding of Western Europe for its fears of Russia as an external threat. And he said repeatedly, in different words, that the biggest threats that Europe's democracies were facing were not the enemies at the gates, but the enemies within. If anyone doubted that the new administration was not looking for a warm confirmation of transatlantic bonds, have a look at the Signal chat that we all know about now between members of Donald Trump's cabinet. When they were discussing the attack against the Houthis to make sure that the Suez Canal will be safely shippable again, J.D. Vance said in the chat, I just hate bailing Europe out again. The Minister of Defense, Pete Hegseth, confirmed and said, quote, that he shares your, J.D. Vance's, loathing of European freeloading. And he added, it's pathetic. All capital letters. Pathetic. Europe, pathetic, a freeloader, worth of loathing. These are tones that we're not used to from the White House. And whenever I discuss the Trump administration nowadays, people often approach me and ask, since when has it become commonplace for an American administration to hate Europe? Is this not a truly new phenomenon? Well, I have the pleasure of today discuss this with someone who is uniquely suited to shed light on this, Jack Thompson. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Claudia.
It's wonderful having you because you have crisscrossed the Atlantic in your career. You're an American. You have parts of your education in the United States. You hold an MA from the Johns Hopkins University, very fine institution in Baltimore, Maryland. But you did your PhD, your doctoral work at the University of Cambridge, and you've worked for a long time in Europe. How many European countries have you lived in so far?
Half dozen, maybe.
Half dozen.
Six, seven?
No. Yeah.
Too many.
Yeah, that's more than most Europeans have lived in, for sure. You've been a lecturer at the University College Dublin, and you have also been in Switzerland. So you know our system quite well, too, because you worked as team head and senior researcher at the Center for Security Studies of ETH Zurich. Then you switched across the EU-Switzerland border, so to speak, and went to become a senior strategic analyst at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies in the Netherlands. And now you are a lecturer in American Studies at the University of Amsterdam, also in the Netherlands, of course. And your field of research, in a sense, combines international relations and history because you have focused on the foreign policy of Theodore Roosevelt. Your first monograph, award-winning monograph, one has to add, Great Power Rising, focused on Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy. And in your think tank work, you have also worked a lot on U.S. foreign policy. So you're the ideal guest to shed light on how unique this really is that a U.S. administration speaks with so much disdain and even disgust, I would say, at times about Europe and so-called European freeloading. And you can also give us maybe an inkling as to what might be ways of responding. as European states to this. But before we dive into this, I usually ask my guests, what was their first American experience? What do they consider typically American? But you are in the reverse situation. You're an American in Europe. So when you moved to Switzerland a couple of years ago, what struck you as typically Swiss?
So I think it's worth starting by mentioning most non-Swiss people have a very specific and I think cliched idea of what Switzerland is, right? You know, the Swiss Alps and wonderful chocolates and kind of this quaint little country where everything works really well. And I mean, there's a reason for these stereotypes, right? Because, you know, the Swiss Alps are amazingly beautiful and the chocolate is pretty good. And things do work amazingly well. So the stereotypes are all to an extent true. We moved to Switzerland from Ireland, which nice place to live. It's a little more gritty, a little more, things are a little more relaxed, let's say. And I still remember the first time my wife was pregnant, 7 or 8 months pregnant, we moved to Switzerland. And the first time we walked in the hospital in Zollikerberg, and we walked in the front door, and it felt like we were stepping onto the set of a science fiction movie, because everything was so kind of clean and white and modern. And I remember seeing like doctors and nurses walking down the hall, and they were just very kind of relaxed, and they were smiling. And the contrast with what we were seeing in Ireland was, or what we had seen in Ireland was so stark. Wow. Because in Ireland, the doctors and nurses were all wonderful, but like there were no chairs, pregnant women were sitting on the ground. Like, it was much more chaotic. And so our initial kind of impression of Switzerland was very positive, but also like very much aligned with kind of the stereotype. Now, as we lived there longer, you know, you start to get, things get a little more complicated. I realized that there was a kind of a subtle but very strong form of Swiss nationalism, which I had never thought about, never encountered, which is very interesting for someone who's interested in kind of nationalism and things like that. It was very interesting to kind of encounter that firsthand. I remember distinctly on multiple occasions being scolded. I speak reasonably good Hochdeutsch. I remember being scolded on multiple occasions for not having yet learned Zürichdeutsch. which, you know, at the time is kind of like, but in retrospect is kind of, it's almost sweet, right? Like it's, you know, I trust you enough to tell you I'm unhappy with what you're doing right now. Don't speak to me in Hochdeutsch. Speak to me in dialect. So.
And I mean, take it as a compliment. So your Hochdeutsch was good enough for people to expect you to move on to the next step, actually. I remember very well when we met in Switzerland that you shared one of the first German words you learned while being in Switzerland, in addition to your vocabulary, and that was, I don't know whether you remember, steuergünstig.
That's right. Steuergünstig.
Which is also a Swiss thing.
Yes,
having lived in half a dozen European states by now, is there something you would say is distinctly European, where you could say this is really typically European in contrast to typically American? Or is every country just on its own typically something?
So I think to an extent what you're talking about is identity, right? Not to get too academic right off the bat. And as you know very well, identity comes, there's two aspects to identity. One is kind of how we see ourselves, but it's also kind of how we see ourselves in opposition to some kind of other, right? And I think the other part is becoming much clearer for a lot of Europeans, or has become much clearer for a lot of Europeans in the last few months or last few years. In terms of things that are intrinsically European, I mean, I think I have maybe a slightly different perspective on this, being someone who has emigrated to Europe kind of voluntarily and, you know, who plans to stay here long term. There is, I think, a way of mixing the free market and good, or at least theoretically good, administration and governance, which is, you can find in a few other places, Canada, Australia, there are a few other examples, but otherwise is not that common. which I think Europeans overall, broadly speaking, do very, very well, and which the average European kind of expects, in a way that, you know, certainly most, certainly Americans on the left can only kind of dream of, right? There's also kind of a shared history, which I think most Europeans don't necessarily think about. But again, as someone who has moved here from the outside, I'm always aware of, I'm very aware of, right? Not just the good, there's all plenty of good shared history, but there's also, you know, obviously some unpleasant shared history as well. But that's part of what makes a unique place unique. And then, you know, there's linguistic stuff, obviously. You know, I mean, I'm a native English speaker. My first foreign language that I learned was German. And when it came time to learn Dutch, it was kind of just splitting the difference between English and German. I mean, my first couple of years of Dutch lessons, I would often just speak German, much to the amusement and horror of my Dutch teachers. But because these are all, you know, Germanic languages, you know, they're not that far apart. So that's a very kind of disjointed answer, but I think it's, you know, from my perspective, at least, accurate.
Yeah, I kind of second the observation that we are often highlighting the differences in our history, but that essentially we are bonded by a common experience and an often shared lens on what has bonded us and also driven us apart at times. And at the moment, we are also sharing a certain feeling, at least in Western parts of Europe, a feeling of hurt and also disorientation when we're looking across the Atlantic and when we're listening and reading of what comes from a certain part there, namely the White House. And as I said in the intro, and you were already vigorously nodding along when I cited the speech by J.D. Vance at the security conference in Munich, there is this perception that the current administration, in its foreign policy, in its stance on defense, is uniquely, and that's what people repeatedly say, uniquely anti-European. Do you see that similarly, or does the historian see something else?
So I'm actually writing a book about anti-Europeanism and U.S. foreign policy. So I want to be careful not to give too much of the good stuff away.
No spoilers.
No spoilers. But yes, I mean, it's an astute question because, I mean, if we think about kind of the modern history of the transatlantic relationship, obviously what we're seeing now is unprecedented, right? So we haven't seen this kind of in the post-World War II era. To be sure, there has always been an undercurrent of frustration, anger, condescension in the way that certainly American policymakers have thought about their European allies. But it was very much kind of kept in check by kind of the rigidities that came with the Cold War, right? And again, this discussion of the common, you know, the external other, which was, you know, the Soviet Empire. So in the modern sense, yes, what we're seeing is unprecedented. Of course, if you look at the broader history of the transatlantic relationship, what we're seeing now actually starts to look a lot more familiar. I mean, it's a modern incarnation of a much older aspect of American political culture that you can actually trace all the way back to 1776. If you go back and read what's the initial framers of the Constitution, kind of initial early figures like Benjamin Franklin and John Adams, Thomas Jefferson was a big one, what they were saying about Europe, there are a lot of parallels with what you're seeing people like J.D. Vance and some of the other people in the Trump administration and kind of people in the broader right-wing political culture are saying today, right? And well, I'll stop there, but we can delve into that more if you want. But it's in the broader scope of sweep of American history, this is not new. It's more kind of, it's almost Americans rediscovering where they started when it came to Europe.
Let's stick briefly with the 20th and early 21st century, because you said that it had been present, this level, a certain condescension you mentioned, that there was also frustration with Europe. Was it also on the same subjects? Was it also on carrying its weight in defense spending, etc.? Or were there other issues that frustrated the U.S.?
So defense spending was certainly, and kind of this broader sense of burden sharing in the transatlantic security architecture, from day one, that was a source of tension. And to an extent, that was warranted. It was also at times very hypocritical on the part of American policymakers, because even as they would complain that Europeans were not spending enough on defense or doing enough, carrying their fair share of the burden in defense, American policymakers would simultaneously discourage Europeans from becoming too capable or from becoming too independent, because that would reduce the amount of control that American policymakers had. So Americans in the modern era, if we're talking about post-World War II, American policymakers have always kind of wanted to, in a sense, have their cake and eat it too. They want Europeans to take more of the burden, but they don't want the Europeans to get too independent, right? Because they still want, the U.S. still wants to be kind of, it didn't want an equal partnership, right? It wanted to have, to be the one kind of calling the shots for the most part. So burden sharing has always been an issue. Of course, there are important differences in getting back to this question of what makes Europe Europe. There are important differences in political culture. American political culture is by nature kind of has historically been a bit more individualistic, a bit more skeptical of the value of centralized authority. Whereas Europeans, certainly post-World War II, Europeans tended to be a bit more comfortable with kind of a stronger, more powerful social safety net, a stronger, more powerful welfare state. And certainly kind of on the right of American politics, this was always viewed with at least a little bit of suspicion, right? And the further out on the right you get, I mean, the John Birch Society, for example, they were horrified by kind of collectivism in Western Europe and were convinced that the U.S. was on the road to Western European-style collectivism. And so that, of course, fed into kind of what you were seeing in mainstream conversations about Europe.
The John Birch Society is an important reference for all those familiar with 1960s, 1950s U.S., but that might not be every listener. So can you clue us all in on what the Birch Society was? Because I think it's actually quite interesting how much of the John Bircher rhetoric is also coming back.
Or maybe it never went away.
That's another way.
We could have an entire conversation about that. John Birch Society was basically founded in the late 1950s. And it was part of, to an extent, it was kind of an extreme manifestation, or one of the more extreme manifestations of kind of the Red Scare. It was founded as a group, as a grassroots kind of right-wing organization concerned about things like, especially about communism, but also more broadly about an erosion of what you might call, or what they would call, traditional American values, right? And so for them, obviously the Soviet Union was kind of the foremost external other that they rallied against. But if you read kind of some of the early writings, Western Europe was also a pretty significant bogeyman in the way that they, in their worldview, because they were worried that that a mixed approach to the economy, where you have a stronger or a higher level of intervention by the state, was kind of, that the U.S. was kind of sliding down that path, and not in a good way. And so the John Birch Society kind of functioned as kind of a Greek chorus on the fringe of the Republican Party, constant urging it to be more vigilant against communism, more vigilance against collectivism. A lot of this had to do with kind of the dominance of the New Deal, kind of political, the power of New Deal Democrats in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. John Birch Society was kind of an extreme kind of reaction to that. And John Birch Society kind of hovered on the fringes for a long time. Still exists, by the way.
It never has been dissolved.
It's still there. And I would argue they started a lot of the ideas and the and the kind of the rhetorical tools that the John Birch Society kind of helped keep alive really started to migrate back into the mainstream of the right in the 1990s. But again, that's maybe a slightly separate conversation.
Also, this conspiratorial thinking that has made a big resurgence in recent years.
For sure.
What I've been wondering, you mentioned that burden sharing had always been a point of criticism during post-World War II transatlantic relations. Also, a bit of skepticism / suspicion towards the European political culture and economic model. What I was struck by recently was how Donald Trump described the European Union as a organization that was created to, I think his words were, to get the United States, whereas the United States was actually an enabler of its creation. So how recent or how common was this anti-EU, anti-European community, anti-common market rhetoric prior to Donald Trump?
Okay. So a disclaimer before we get into any of this, which is anyone who delves too deeply into the psyche of Donald Trump, you know, risks. I mean, there's just a lot that we don't know, right?
Oh, yeah. We've had this discussion in a recent podcast episode that there's a micro industry of people trying to understand him. And at the end of the day, we're not his therapist, so.
Right. Okay. Caveat aside, disclaimer aside. So in a lot of ways, my interpretation of this is that what we're seeing now is kind of the coming together of two separate strands of American political culture, or one strand of American political culture and one turns out very powerful individual. And his kind of his own personal worldview coming together in the Trump administration. So the kind of the strand of American political culture is this, what you can call, you know, a version of American nationalism or even kind of anti-Europeanism. Again, not to provide too many spoiler alerts for the book that I'm writing. But this was from 1776 all the way up into the early 20th century, kind of the foremost pillar of American foreign policy was the conviction that remaining unentangled in Europe's problems was the most important thing that Americans could do to preserve their independence and the longevity of their own unique political institutions, right? And this was around until kind of the early 1950s. It finally kind of died out. There's one last big fight over things like the Marshall Plan, over NATO, kind of the old, what are sometimes referred to as isolationists in the Republican Party. They all kind of lost that fight in the late 40s, early 50s. And this kind of this very powerful combination of isolationism or unilateralism, whatever you want to call it, and anti-Europeanism, it didn't disappear. It just kind of, it moved off to the margins, right? But it stayed there. And it started to make a comeback in the 1990s with people like Pat Buchanan. And we really started to see it kind of explode around the time that the Tea Party took off, around 2009, 2010. Donald Trump did not create kind of this anti-Europeanism. He just kind of helped accelerate it, right? So that's the first part of this equation. The second part is kind of Trump's own personal worldview. If you go back and read kind of the earliest public pronouncements on politics that Trump made, a lot of them come from the late 1980s, early 1990s, and they're obsessed with this idea that American allies, West Germany, at that point, West Germany, Japan, that they were ripping off the United States. Now, does that sound familiar? It does.
Very
much. He's still obsessed with this, right? He didn't, as far as we can tell from kind of the early, you know, Donald Trump does not have an especially kind of elaborate or coherent worldview. And my own personal take on his kind of political worldview is that much of it is just an extension of the lessons that he learned in business in New York and in the real estate markets. And, you know, his kind of his mentor, of course, Roy Cohn, was closely allied with Joseph McCarthy. And so this is a very this is a worldview that's very zero sum. There's no room for kind of win-win. It's a very kind of cynical Darwinian kind of worldview.
And that Trump comes with a certain
has
ruthlessness.
Largely kind of. Yeah, exactly, for sure. And Trump has kind of extrapolated from these own lessons he learned as a businessman in New York to kind of his view of how U.S. foreign policy should function. And so he's very skeptical of the idea that, a foundational idea for the entire transatlantic alliance is essentially collective security and multilateralism, yeah. Right? That kind of giving up a certain, a degree of sovereignty to join forces leaves kind of both sides of the partnership better off in the long run, right? In Trump's worldview, there is no, that's impossible, right? It's a zero-sum interaction. And if you are not getting the better part of, or if you're not coming out on top of some sort of interaction, you're losing out, right? And so the things that he was saying in the late 80s, early 90s about kind of trade with West Germany and with Japan, he's basically saying the same thing, fast forward 40 years or whatever it is to today. He's basically saying the same thing. And so you have the dovetailing of this long-running kind of nationalism and kind of skepticism of Europe with Trump's own kind of personal obsession with this idea that American allies have been ripping off the United States with unfair trade deals and not spending. And this kind of ripping the United States off allows them to underspend on defense.
And then we have the missing other that we can join forces against, as we had under the Cold War, where we were forced to be united and where the United States was willing to maybe have the more burdensome share of the so-called collective security. Is it maybe that Europe failed to recognize that it requires another and that they should maybe help and, how shall we say, join the construction of the other in China, for instance?
I mean, if you talk to centrist Democrats or kind of mainstream Democrats in the United States, I don't think they would put it in exactly those terms, but essentially what they would suggest is kind of an updating of the transatlantic alliance, in which Europeans would, again, kind of increase defense spending so that they could take more of the responsibility for security in Europe and Eurasia, which would allow the United States to focus all of its, or the vast majority of its resources and energy on the Indo-Pacific, right? So in some ways, what you're seeing from kind of right-wing foreign policy intellectuals and left-wing foreign policy intellectuals, there's some overlap. But the right-wing version is, as you saw with the J.D. Vance speech, is a much, it's a much more, it's a vision of Europe that's much uglier and much more suspicious. Whereas kind of the left-wing vision of this envisions in many ways a more equal partnership.
Yeah.
With Europe, and in which both sides benefit from kind of a slightly different division of labor.
And many people often call Trump's foreign policy as isolationist. Do you think that's an accurate description? Is it truly isolationist, given that he also has very, shall we say, audacious plans with regards to the future of American territory?
No. Historians of American foreign policy don't really like the term isolationism because U.S. foreign policy has never really been isolationist. A better term is usually unilateralist. So the only time where you can point to U.S. foreign policy as maybe seeking to isolate itself from kind of external problems is maybe kind of a minority of politicians in the 1930s. In the years kind of before the U.S. actually joined World War II, you can point to some, especially kind of Midwestern members of Congress who really did kind of advocate kind of as much as possible cutting the links between the Western Hemisphere and the rest of the world. But even that, I think, is debatable. And otherwise, the U.S. has always been engaged internationally. It's just that prior to World War II, it was most comfortable doing so outside of any sort of collective security arrangement. right? And this goes all the way back to the lessons that Americans kind of took from the Revolutionary War. There was an alliance between the U.S. and France. This alliance was absolutely essential to U.S. victory over the British Empire during the Revolutionary War. But the U.S., even as this alliance was still in place, I mean, having gone back and spent some time in the archives, you can see that even then, American leaders are very conscious of the fact that they're in danger of becoming kind of caught in the middle of this ongoing conflict between the British Empire and the French Empire. And so as quickly as possible, they extricated themselves from the alliance of France. And thereafter, one of the starting point, the first rule in American foreign policy was no permanent alliances, right? No entanglement in European political or military problems, because the U.S., at first, this is a matter of weakness. During the 19th century, there was concern that at first the U.S. wouldn't actually survive all the way up until the War of 1812, the British Empire. And thereafter, it was a concern that European powers, especially the British Empire, but others potentially as well, would prevent the U.S. from asserting full control over the what is now the continental U.S., right? So, yeah, this has been a long-running theme. This kind of unilateralism was the starting point for U.S. foreign policy all the way up until World War II. Again, it didn't disappear completely, but it was kind of pushed off to the fringes during the Cold War because you had this common external enemy and because most Americans recognized that the world had changed, technology had changed, that the U.S., the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean were no longer sufficient to protect the United States from problems in Asia or problems in Europe. But in places like the John Birch Society, kind of this instinct for unilateralism, it survived. And if you go back and read someone like Pat Buchanan, for example, he wrote an essay, I think in 1990, called America First, Second, and Third. Right. So already as soon as the Cold War ended, you had prominent figures coming out and saying, hey, we need to go back to, you know, the good old days when we were unilateralist. And so an element of that has finally kind of reemerged as a mainstream foreign policy worldview. So the Trump administration, to round off this very long answer to your question, I view the Trump administration's foreign policy as a nationalist foreign policy, not an isolationist foreign policy. And a key element of that nationalism is unilateralism.
The interesting part is, aside from everything you said, but what has been striking me when you explained how anti-Europeanism has been a theme since the U.S. founding is that, well, we are now in a position where the United States does not have to fear its destruction because it's just a small player as it was at its inception. But it's essentially still, when we're looking in terms of military and economic might, a hegemon. It could be if it wanted to remain one. It's just a very costly endeavor. So I was wondering, is maybe this resurging of anti-Europeanism and this nationalist trend or nationalist turn in foreign policy, is it also an expression of perceived weakness that we see all these old forms of discourse coming back?
One way of thinking of this is that the anti-Europeanism, if you want to call it that, is kind of like an instinctive reflex that's been there for a long time in American political culture, and that it, as kind of external conditions change, the reflex is still there, but it manifests in response to different conditions, right? So certainly kind of for the first 40, 50, 60 years of the American Republic, a considerable amount of anti-Europeanism was coming from a place of weakness, right? A fear that Europe could quite literally destroy the United States if it wanted to, or some European power could destroy the United States. Post-World War II, anti-Europeanism tend to focus on kind of the problems posed not by European strength, but by European weakness, right? So there was frustration that Europe was not doing enough to defend itself, even though it would be the first one, you know, it would be on the front line of any kind of conventional military confrontation with the Soviet Union, right? More recently, I would say it's a combination of things. Sometimes it's about European weakness. It's still kind of, or perceived European weakness. There's still this ongoing kind of frustration with Europe's unwillingness or inability to spend what the US wanted to spend on defense. Sometimes it's on when it comes to European strength. So an important influence in the Trump administration is kind of big tech.
Yeah.
And big tech is actually very concerned about the regulatory powers of the European Union. So that's not European weakness, that's European strength. And there's also something that's a bit more abstract, but I think still really matters, which is what a lot of conservatives view as the corrupting influence of what you might call or what you might see as European culture. So things like what the right wing tends to call cultural Marxism, for example, obviously, you know, that comes from Europe. Secularism, you know, that's seen, I think, for a lot of Americans, especially a lot of right-wing Americans, that's a European thing. As if we couldn't, you know, be secular on our own. We need the Europeans to corrupt us for that.
And there's something called the First Amendment, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, right. But so I think there is this this concern that European, quote unquote, European cultural influences are somehow corrupting, and that the U.S. needs to protect itself from those things. And so the anti-Europeanism, it's this reflex, and it kind of, it's flexible. It evolves in response to kind of the way that Europe is changing. And so this is, I sense, I guess, essentially an argument that this anti-Europeanism is always going to be there. It will wax and wane. It will, in other words, it will grow and shrink depending on lots of different factors. But at least some Americans are always going to be inclined to look at Europe and say, that's different. Therefore, it's dangerous and I need to protect myself from that.
It's kind of a mirror image of European anti-American, which is also waxing and waning at the moment. It's pretty much there. And that is also, well, it's not based on the same things, but it often comes out of a perceived European weakness, a perceived American strength, and also these corrupting cultural influences. I've heard that before. Just with America in the mix. So quite interesting how we're the same again in this regard. I would like to tap into something else because I've been wondering to what extent can we find historical precedents for the Trump presidency? And you've mentioned already in the beginning that the way he is pursuing his foreign policy is quite unprecedented. But at the same time, he thinks that there are precursors to himself, and he tries to put himself as their heir at times. And I'm speaking of President McKinley, someone most people are probably not that familiar with until they heard about the tariffs and the ambition of the president to rename Mount Denali again into Mount McKinley. And the other president I've been thinking about, because he must be on Donald Trump's mind as well, is Theodore Roosevelt, the man who had the honor of inaugurating the Panama Canal that that Donald Trump is also lusting after. To what extent do you see any connection to these progressive era presidents to Donald Trump? If we're just discarding his style and all of that?
So this is a good question. And a number of people have asked me the same question in a couple different, you know, from slightly different angles.
At least we're creative when it comes to the angle.
The first thing to say in all this is Donald Trump does not sit around reading history books thinking, I'd like to pattern myself after one of my predecessors. Which one is the best fit? I mean, he just doesn't work that way, right?
Absolutely.
But to be sure, there are plenty of people around him who do think that way. McKinley has been kind of a common touchstone for a lot of modern Republicans. I think mostly because he kicked off an era of Republican dominance. He kind of helped create a realignment in American politics that saw Republicans not completely dominate, but definitely kind of have the better of side of things in American politics, really up until the New Deal era. And so I think a lot of Republican intellectuals and strategists, I mean, Karl Rove, for example, 20
he
years
wrote
ago,
a book he used about to, it, yeah.
Yeah, he used to very openly talk about kind of trying to do the same thing. And not only did he talk about it, he actually tried to position George W. Bush as the heir to McKinley in terms of kind of creating this realignment in American politics that would allow the center right to dominate. Didn't work out, but that was Rove's, you know, he was pretty open about that's what he wanted to do. And so I think some of the more history-minded Republicans or more history-minded folks on the right, they talk about McKinley not necessarily because they want to do all the same things that he used to do, but because they'd like to have the political power that they perceived him having. So that's one part. Another part, of course, is this resurgence of nationalism, right? And so McKinley's presidency saw the U.S. take Hawaii. It saw the U.S. Begin the process that would end with kind of Theodore Roosevelt's quote-unquote taking the canal. It saw the U.S. basically kind of decide that it would act as the hegemon in the Western Hemisphere. And so obviously anyone who's been paying attention to the Trump administration's pronouncements about Greenland or about Canada or about the Panama Canal will recognize some echoes there, right? McKinley can be seen as kind of a high point of American expansionism and American nationalism. And then the part where Trump comes back into this is his obsession with tariffs. Now, anyone who's been following kind of international trade news will know that it turns out the Trump administration did not fully think through its plan in regard to kind of how to use tariffs. But it's my best kind of understanding of this, with definitely with incomplete information, is that Trump doesn't really understand how tariffs work, but latched onto it as a way to address what he sees as this problem of America's trade partners ripping off the United States. And so someone whispered in his ear at some point, oh, you know, when McKinley was president, tariffs were, you know, a big deal. They're a really important part of the Republican platform. We should do that. And hence we now have, you know, we're on the verge of a global trade war.
So not a true heir to McKinley. What do you make of his ambitions with the Panama Canal? Is it just rhetoric? A pregnant pause.
Yeah, well, we have incomplete information about this. So, you know, I stop and think for a second about how I want to formulate it. I think there's a couple things going on. One is there has been long on kind of the fringes of the American right, kind of an obsession with Chinese influence in the Panama Canal. I can remember as a young intern in Congress, answering constituent mail and reading a letter from a constituent in my home district warning about the influence of China in the Panama Canal. And at the time, no one had thought about that. Like this just seemed like a completely crazy. Fast forward 20 years, and it's now obviously a pressing concern for a lot of for a lot of Americans. And there is a grain of truth in these concerns, right? China has made a very concerted effort to establish not just an economic, but in much quieter way, a political presence in Latin America. And the Panama Canal is very important, not just for American, but for global shipping. And so take that legitimate concern and amplify it with decades worth of conspiracy theories, and you get this sense that, you know, China is on the verge of seizing the Panama Canal, and maybe we should seize it first, which is problematic in lots of different ways. But there is an element in this kind of resurgent foreign policy nationalism of a renewed interest in the U.S. maintaining full hegemony over the Western Hemisphere. And this is why you're getting these kind of otherwise seemingly unconnected, very aggressive rhetoric toward Canada, toward Greenland, toward the Panama Canal, places where it looks like potentially external influence kind of dovetails with the nature of geopolitical competition in the 21st century. It's not just about China. It's also about Russia. It's not just the Panama Canal. It's also the Arctic. But it's a side of American foreign policy that used to be kind of the very heart of American foreign policy, and is just kind of, in some ways, it's like back to the future, right? It's like we're back in the 1920s, the 1930s.
Well, and luckily we have a historian who understands that time very well. So you normally delve in history and you go back into the archives, you do close readings of texts that most of us haven't paid enough attention to. You're elucidating the present thanks to that knowledge you're building and the findings you get from that. The future's usually not your métier, nor is it that of anyone else. But still, where do you see transatlantic relations headed in the next, let's say, 5 years?
So prior to my current job as a lecturer at UvA at the University of Amsterdam, I actually spent 2.5 years running the Strategic Foresight Project that was paid for by the Dutch Ministry of Defense and Foreign Affairs. So I did actually spend a couple of years, if not trying to predict the future, at least
making
some gestures in that direction, right? And we would always, the first thing we would put in these reports was this long disclaimer about the fact that no one can predict the future and we're not trying to predict the future. Instead, what we would offer is kind of a couple of different plausible scenarios for how things might play out. And so I guess probably the most responsible way to do that, to answer your question, is to do a version of that, right? So how do I see the future of transatlantic relations playing out? So the best case scenario is, I think, a world in which kind of the current trajectory that we're now seeing with most European countries, where they finally take the need to spend more on defense, and not just spend more on defense, but to, because you spending more on defense can be things like pensions and healthcare, but actually spending more on capabilities and increasing capabilities and doing a better job of cooperating with each other, because this is really important as well, that European countries develop kind of interoperability, that this trend continues, but does so in a way that dovetails with what the US is doing. In other words, that there's continues to be some sort of partnership on both sides, between the US and its European partners, its European allies. And I think, so in other words, an updated version of collective security, I think is the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that, I mean, nationalism has pretty much become the dominant foreign policy worldview on the right in the United States. And if we see a number of successive administrations, all of whom essentially espouse a nationalist foreign policy worldview. So instead of 4 years, we have 8 years or 12 years or 16 years of kind of a nationalist foreign policy. I mean, the collective security won't exist anymore. At least the US won't be part of it, right? The Europeans will almost certainly kind of develop their own version without the US. But kind of this transatlantic version of collective security, if we don't count the Canadians, this version of transatlantic security, collective security that we've known since the end of World War II, that will be gone, right? And the world will be kind of a multipolar world where the US competes with Russia and China, and Europe is constantly kind of being asked to pick sides, and where, because the external security environment will be so much more dangerous, Europe will have less money to spend on things like healthcare and education and infrastructure, things that are actually really important and that help build a nice society. So those are the two kind of extreme scenarios. Of course, the most likely scenario is somewhere in between those two, right? Where you get elements of both. The reality is, for the first foreseeable future, the US will probably oscillate between having kind of democratic administrations, which are internationalist and favor collective security, favor things like NATO, favor alliances, see the value in international cooperation and multilateralism, and Republican administrations, which were going to be nationalist. Who's the single most likely next president of the United States right now? Probably J.D. Vance.
Oh, yeah.
And in some ways, Vance is worse than Trump because he has a much more fully developed vision for what kind of a nationalist foreign policy will look like.
He's ideological,
He's ideological, where Trump is very transactional, right? So I think, I mean, because of the nature of American politics and because the U.S. is so kind of evenly divided, you'll see both Republicans and Republican and Democratic administrations in the foreseeable future. And so you're going to see the U.S. kind of swing wildly back and forth between trying to be, you know, essentially a good international citizen and the U.S. being a much more kind of cranky, selfish, unproductive international citizen. And so Europe is going to have to kind of learn how to insulate itself, become more resilient in the face of kind of these wild swings from the U.S. The U.S. will become a much more unreliable partner. It doesn't mean it won't be a partner. It will sometimes still be a partner, but it'll be a lot less reliable.
It's kind of like a cheating spouse. So it's a rather bleak prospect. Maybe come to a more positive, probable scenario. When is your book coming out?
The goal is to have a manuscript in front of the publisher before the year ends.
Wonderful.
Well, but as you know, the writing process takes as long as it takes, and life tends to get in the way, so we'll see. We'll see what happens with the deadline.
We look forward to reading it, and I think at the very latest, then you have to be back on the podcast so that we can dive into all the spoilers that you were withholding this conversation. Do you have any other recommendations as to what our listeners should read, listen to, or watch to get a better sense of where U.S. foreign policy is headed to, or what we can learn from the past, actually, to understand the current moment?
So in honor of the very pleasant conversation we've just had, and in honor of the medium in which we're engaging right now, I would mention a couple podcasts, which I think are useful. The Ezra Klein Show, which is part of the New York Times kind of family of podcasts, is very good. It's from a center-left perspective, but it's intellectually quite fair, quite honest, and it's wonky, but still accessible. There's another podcast which is a more of a kind of a left-of-center academic intellectual podcast called Know Your Enemy, which is focuses on trying to understand what's happening on the American rights, which is a good listen. Another podcast from the New York Times family of podcasts is a new one. It's run by Ross Douthat, who's kind of the house right-wing intellectual in the New York Times. And he is, I think, pretty clearly been hired by the New York Times to kind of explain conservatism to its kind of left of center readership. And I think he takes a certain amount of glee in trying to kind of explain kind of the, you know, what is for most left of center Americans kind of this very kind of strange world of right-wing intellectuals and things like that. But Douthat is brilliant. He's a brilliant guy. And he's genuinely pretty intellectually honest. So he has a lot of right-wing guests that most people don't know about, but that are important. And he asks them some tough questions. So I think that's another podcast that's worth listening. And for anyone who really wants to kind of get their fingers dirty with so-called primary sources, there is a large and growing segment of podcasts which cater to kind of right-wing listeners, especially kind of young male right-wing listeners, you know, the bro podcasts.
Oh, yeah.
And there's an inexhaustible list. A couple that might be worth checking out are the Joe Rogan. Mm-hmm. I think it's called the Joe Rogan Experience, maybe.
Yeah, it is.
That's worth checking out.
He has been actually recommended by Simon Evenet, a trade economist recently. He also listened to the entire 3-hour conversation with Donald Trump. So, yeah, you're in good company if you listen to that.
One of the interesting things that's changed about the way American presidential campaigns work is legacy media.
Oh, yeah.
Are much less important now than podcasters. Absolutely. And influencers. And I mean, we saw the Trump administration follow kind of a strategy that focused more on kind of podcasters and influencers. And the Kamala Harris campaign followed a slightly more kind of traditional campaign.
Yeah.
And in retrospect,
much more rehearsed.
I mean, it's clear the Trump campaign strategy was more effective, right?
Mm.
So there's the Joe Rogan podcast. Theo Von is another one. maybe slightly less explicitly political than Joe Rogan, but there's a lot of the right-wing bro-y kind of more subtle right-wing political influence going on there. Steve Bannon,
he's around.
He has a podcast. I think it's called The War Room. I've tried to listen to it and can't get it here. I'm not sure if it's being blocked or what the deal is. Maybe some of your listeners can get access to it.
Yeah, free speech in Europe.
I can't get it for whatever reason. But Bannon has already been mentioned as someone who's thinking about running for president in 2028. So he very much has his ear to the ground in terms of kind of what's happening in intellectual circles on the right. And he's a good source for figuring out what right-wing thinkers are saying. So he's also worth checking out.
Fantastic list of listening recommendations, spanning the left with Ezra Klein to the very right with Mr. Bannon. I haven't heard that he wants to run for president, so that will be an interesting show to watch in a sense. Although I have to say, I wouldn't put my money on his winning. Well, thank you so much, Jack, for your time and all your insights. We're looking very much forward to your book so that we don't have just stuff to listen to, but something interesting to read again. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. And thank you to everyone for listening and hearing how old actually anti-Europeanism in US politics actually is, how we are making a journey back in the past, albeit under different circumstances. Thank you so much for your time and auf Wiedersehen.
Thanks, Claudia.
Grüezi Amerika, Views from the Sister Republic, a University of St. Gallen podcast by Claudia Brühwiler.